Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 468, titled Through a Glass Darkly, Looking Ahead to the 2004 Elections. This is being recorded on July 11th of the year 2004. And we're going to get right into the subject material of this program. We're going to begin by taking a look at a mysterious death of a fellow who has been advocating a verified voter paper trail for the upcoming elections. Of course, the subject of electronic voting has been very much on the front burner in terms of one of the issues that people are worried about. Well, one of the people who was worried about it and who was doing something about it died. And under ambiguous circumstances, we're going to take a look at the death of Ethan Gibbs to lead off the show. Then we're going to be taking a look at an article from the New Republic, which talks about U.S. pressure on the Pakistanis to secure, basically to arrest or kill one or more of the top Al-Qaeda or Taliban leadership, such as Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, or Mullah Omar, in a time frame that would correspond with the Democratic Convention. After that, we're going to be taking a look at Chairman Ralph, old shoplifter face, Darth Nader. We're going to begin by taking a look at Republicans who are helping to finance Ralph Nader's campaign. Then we're going to take a look at the fact that Ralph Nader has an autobiography that is being published and flogged by Rupert Murdoch's publishing empire, which is sort of strange given that Murdoch is a Bush supporter, although maybe that's not so strange. We're going to take a look at the mythology of Ralph Nader's claim that he is going to be taking votes away from Republicans. We're also going to take a look at some insidious history of Ralph Nader, including his efforts at destroying people who had been political allies, in particular his leaking of disinformation to the FBI in order to sabotage the political career of a former assistant. Then we're going to take a look at, in keeping with the subject of wolves in sheep's clothing, we're going to be taking a look at the relationship between a key Bush ally named Robert Stone, who organized the mob that basically forced the halt of the Miami-Dade vote recount in 2001, or at the end of 2000 for the 2000 elections. This fellow Roger Stone has been managing the campaign of Al Sharpton, who has proved altogether fractious in New York Democratic ranks. We're going to take a look at that after taking a look at Darth Nader. And, time permitting, we're going to take a look at some eerie forecasts by seismologists on the cutting edge of that discipline. We're going to take a look at eerie forecasts that California may very well experience a large earthquake later this year. That's something I had been worried about. This falls into a gray area that's between reality and paranoia. And unfortunately, under the reign of George II, that dividing line between reality and paranoia has become very much obscured. That's what we have on tap for the broadcast. Let's proceed. We're going to take a look now at the death of Ethan Gibbs. Ethan Gibbs was a specialist on electronic voting, one of the critics of the Diebold Company. He won't be doing that anymore. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Coastal Post Online. This is an article from April of 2004 titled, Mysterious Death Benefits Bush. It's by Bob Fitrakis, F-I-T-R-A-K-I-S, reads in part as follows. The subject line on yesterday's email read, Another mysterious accident solves a Bush problem. Ethan Gibbs dead, Diebold lives, unquote. The attached news story briefly described the untimely Friday, March 12th death of perhaps America's most influential advocate of a verified voting paper trail in the era of touchscreen computer voting. Gibbs, an accountant for more than 30 years and the inventor of the TrueVote system, died when his vehicle collided with an 18-wheeled truck, which rolled his Chevy Blazer over several times and forced it over the highway retaining wall where it came to rest on its roof, skipping down. Gibbs' death bears heightened scrutiny because of the way he lived his life after the 2000 Florida election debacle. I interviewed Ethan Gibbs in January of this year. Quote, I've been an accountant, an auditor for more than 30 years. Electronic voting machines that don't supply a paper trail go against every principle of accounting and auditing that's being taught in American business schools, he insisted. Again quoting, These machines are set up to provide paper trails. No business in America would buy a machine that didn't provide a paper trail to audit and verify its transaction. Now, they want the people to purchase machines that you can't audit? It's absurd, unquote. Gibbs was in Columbus, Ohio, proudly displaying his True Vote machine that offered a VVPAT, that's a voter verified paper audit trail, he noted. Gibbs also suggested that I look into the, quote, people behind the other machines, unquote. He offered that Diebold and ES&S are real interesting at all Republicans. If you're an investigative reporter, go ahead and investigate. You'll find some interesting material, unquote. Gibbs' True Vote machine is a marvel. After voters touch the screen, a paper ballot prints out under plexiglass, and once the voter compares it to his actual vote and approves it, the ballot drops into a lockbox and is issued a numbered receipt. The voter's receipt allows him to track his particular vote to make sure that it was transferred from the polling place to the Election Tabulation Center. My encounter with Gibbs led to a cover story in the Columbus Free Press March and April issue entitled Diebold, Electronic Voting and the Vast Right-Wing Conspiracy, unquote. The thesis I advanced in the Free Press article, and gives a URL, is that some of the same right-wing individuals who backed the CIA's covert actions and overthrowing of democratic elections in the Third World in the 1980s are now involved in privatized touchscreen voting. Additionally, I co-wrote an article with Harvey Wasserman that was posted at MotherJones.com on March 5, 2004. Both articles outline ties between far-right elements of the Republican Party and Diebold and ES&S, which count the majority of the nation's electronic votes. As I wrote in the Free Press article, quote, proponents of a paper trail were emboldened when Ethan Gibbs, president and CEO of True Vote International, demonstrated a voting machine at a vendor's fair in Columbus that provides two separate voting receipts. In an interview on WVKO Radio, Gibbs calmly and methodically explained the dangers of black box touchscreen voting. Quote, it absolutely makes no sense to buy electronic voting machines that can't produce a paper trail. Inevitably, computers mess up. How are you going to have a recount or correct malfunctions without a paper trail? Now, the man asking the obvious question and demonstrating an obvious tangible solution is dead in another tragic accident a week after both articles were in circulation. When I called True Vote International to verify Gibbs' death, I reached Chief Financial Officer Adrian Brandon, who assured me, we're going on in his memory. We're going to make sure this happens. Every American concerned with democracy should pledge to make this happen. To beat back the rush for state governments to purchase privatized, partisan, and unreliable electronic voting machines without verified paper trails. Gibbs' last words to me were, how do you explain what happened to Senator Max Cleland in Georgia? How do you explain that? The Maryland study and the Johns Hopkins scientists have warned us against blind faith voting. These systems can be hacked into. They found patches in Georgia, and the people servicing the machine had entered the machines during the voting process. How can we, the people, accept this? No more blind voting. Unquote. Rest in peace, Ethan Gibbs. So once again, another suspicious death benefits the Bush administration. There have been a few of those. Many people have been wondering around the world whether there would be a timely capture of an Al-Qaeda suspect in order to benefit the Bush campaign. One fellow who had been a Bush appointee and resigned from the administration said basically this administration has no policies, it's all politics. And that would appear to be a consideration front and center in the following story. This is from the New Republic Online. Once again, research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. In this story, we're going to take a look at the allegations that the U.S. is pressuring the Pakistanis to capture a top Al-Qaeda operative in such a time frame as to basically overshadow or pull the political rug out from under the Democratic convention. This is called July Surprise? Question mark. The article is actually, the full title is Pakistan for Bush. July Surprise by John B. Judas, Spencer Ackerman, and Masood Ansari. It's dated July 7th, and it reads in part as follows. Late last month, President Bush lost his greatest advantage in his bid for re-election. A poll conducted by ABC News and the Washington Post discovered that challenger John Kerry was running even with the president on the critical question of whom voters trust to handle the war on terrorism. Largely as a result of the deteriorating occupation of Iraq, Bush lost what was in April a seemingly prohibitive 21-point advantage on his signature issue. But even as the president's poll numbers were sliding, his administration was implementing a plan to ensure the public's confidence in his hunt for al-Qaeda. This spring, the administration significantly increased its pressure on Pakistan to kill or capture Osama bin Laden, his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, or the Taliban's Mullah Muhammad Omar, all of whom are believed to be hiding in the lawless tribal areas of Pakistan. A succession of high-level American officials, from outgoing CIA Director George Tenet to Secretary of State Colin Powell to Assistant Secretary of State Christian Rocha to State Department Counterterrorism Chief Kofor Black to a top CIA South Asia official, have visited Pakistan in recent months to urge General Pervez Musharraf's government to do more in the war on terrorism. In April, Zalmay Khalilzad, the American ambassador to Afghanistan, publicly chided the Pakistanis for providing a, quote, sanctuary, unquote, for al-Qaeda and Taliban forces crossing the Afghan border. Quote, "The problem has not been solved and needs to be solved. The sooner, the better," he said. This public pressure would be appropriate, even laudable, had it not been accompanied by an unseemly private insistence that the Pakistanis deliver these high-value targets, or HVTs, before Americans go to the polls in November. The Bush administration denies it has geared the war on terrorism to the electoral calendar. Quote, "Our attitude and actions have been the same since September 11th in terms of getting high-value targets off the street, and that doesn't change because of an election," unquote, says National Security Council spokesman Sean McCormick. But the New Republic has learned that Pakistani security officials have been told they must produce HVTs by the election. According to one source in Pakistan's powerful Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, quote, "The Pakistani government is really desperate and wants to flush out bin Laden and his associates after the latest pressures from the U.S. administration to deliver before the upcoming U.S. elections," unquote. Introducing target dates for al-Qaeda captures is a new twist in U.S.-Pakistani counterterrorism relations, according to a recently departed intelligence official. Quote, "No timetables," unquote, were discussed in 2002 or 2003, but the November election is apparently bringing a new deadline pressure to the hunt. Another official, this one from the Pakistani Interior Ministry, which is responsible for internal security, explains, quote, "The Musharraf government has a history of rescuing the Bush administration. They now want Musharraf to bail them out when they are facing hard times in the coming elections," unquote. These sources insisted on remaining anonymous. Under Pakistan's Official Secrets Act, an official leaking information to the press can be imprisoned for up to 10 years. A third source, an official who works under ISI's director, Lieutenant General Eshan Ul Haq, informed TNR that the Pakistanis, quote, "have been told at every level that apprehension or killing of HBTs before the election is an absolute must," unquote. What's more, this source claims that Bush administration officials have told their Pakistani counterparts that they have a date in mind for announcing this achievement, quote, "The last 10 days of July deadline has been given repeatedly by visitors to Islamabad and during Al-Haq's meetings in Washington," says McCormick. Again quoting, I'm aware of no such comment. But according to this ISI official, White House aide told Al-Haq last spring that, quote, "it would be best if the arrest or killing of any high-value target were announced on the 26th, 27th, or 28th of July, the first 3 days of the Democratic National Convention in Boston." The Bush administration has matched this public and private pressure with enticements and implicit threats. During his visit to Islamabad, Powell designated Pakistan a major non-NATO ally, a status that allows its military to purchase a wider array of U.S. weaponry. Powell pointedly refused to criticize Musharraf for pardoning nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan, who the previous month had admitted exporting nuclear secrets to Iran, North Korea, and Libya, declaring Khan's transgressions an internal, unquote, Pakistani issue. In addition, the administration is pushing a 5-year, $3 billion aid package for Pakistan through Congress over democratic concerns about the country's proliferation of nuclear technology and lack of democratic reform. But Powell conspicuously did not commit the United States to selling F-16s to Pakistan, which it desperately wants in order to tilt the regional balance of power against India. And the Pakistanis fear that if they don't produce an HVT, they won't get the planes. Equally, they fear that if they don't deliver, either Bush or a prospective Kerry administration would turn its attention to the apparent role of Pakistan's security establishment in facilitating Khan's illicit proliferation network. One Pakistani general recently in Washington confided in a journalist, quote, "If we don't find these guys by the election, they're going to stick this whole nuclear mess up our ass," unquote. Pakistani perceptions of U.S. politics reinforce these worries. Again, quoting, "In Pakistan, there's been a folk belief that whenever there's a Republican administration in office, relations with Pakistan have been very good," unquote, says Khalid Hassan, a U.S. correspondent for the Lahore-based Daily Times. By contrast, there's also a, quote, "folk belief that the Democrats are always pro-India," unquote. Recent history has validated those beliefs. The Clinton administration inherited close ties to Pakistan, forged a decade earlier in collaboration against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. But by the time Clinton left office, the United States had tilted toward India, and Pakistan was under U.S. sanctions for its nuclear activities. All this has given Musharraf reason not just to respond to pressure from Bush, but to feel invested in him, and to worry that Kerry, who called the Khan affair a disaster and who has proposed tough new curbs on nuclear proliferation, would adopt an icier line. Bush's strategy could work, in part because of the increased U.S. pressure Musharraf has over the last several months significantly increased military activity in the tribal areas, regions that enjoy considerable autonomy from Islamabad, and where, until Musharraf sided with the United States in the war on terrorism, Pakistani soldiers had never set foot in the nation's 50-year history. Later on, the article notes that if, in fact, such military adventures continue, it could ultimately prove to ignite a pro-Islamist war between Islamists and the current regime in Pakistan. That cautionary note coming from, among others, a CIA analyst who believes the U.S. is losing the current war on, quote, terror, unquote. Now, a lot of people have speculated about whether Osama bin Laden or somebody else would be produced in time for the elections. This indicates specific pressure. This article indicates specific pressure on the Pakistanis to produce a capture by the time of the election. So that is a very, very interesting consideration indeed. We're going to take a look now at Darth Nader, at old Ralph is at it once again, claiming he's going to be taking votes away from George Bush. No doubt, that's why he appointed a member of the Green Party to be his vice presidential running mate, because he wants to take all those green votes away from George Bush. Obviously, by the way, I'm being sarcastic. We're going to take a look at Darth Nader, old shoplifter face, as I call him right now. San Francisco Chronicle, front page, Friday, July 9th, 2004, article by Carla Marinucci, GOP donors funding Nader, reads in part, "Independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, still not on the ballot in a single state, has received a recent windfall of contributions from deep-pocketed Republicans with a history of big contributions to the party, an analysis of federal records show. Nearly 1 in 10 of Nader's major donors, those writing checks of $1,000 or more, have given in recent months to the Bush-Cheney campaign, the latest documents show. GOP fundraisers also have bundled contributions, gathering hefty donations for maximum effect to help Nader, who has criticized the practice in the past. The donations from wealthy Republicans, combined with increasingly vocal Democratic charges that they represent a stealth GOP effort to wound Democrat John Kerry, prompted Nader's vice presidential running mate, Green Party member Peter Camejo, to suggest the consumer advocate reject the money that doesn't come from loyal Nader voters." Well, Police Chief Louis Reynaud said in Casablanca, I am shocked That is about as predictable as anything could possibly be. Indeed, the Republicans were providing logistical support to his campaign in 2000. Article from Salon.com, musing on Nader's pretensions to taking votes away from the Republicans. This is an article by Peter Dizekes, or Dizekes, D-I-Z-E-K-E-S. It's from Salon.com of June 10th, 2004. It's titled Nader's Republican Pipe Dream. It reads, subtitled, "The spoiler candidate insists he's drawing GOP voters away from George W. Bush. There's only one problem. They only exist in his mind." It reads in part, "Ralph Nader's latest presidential campaign does not have an official slogan. It does, however, have a kind of official rationalization." Quote, "I think I'm going to take more votes away from Republicans than from Democrats," Nader says almost every time he speaks. Democrats doubt this theory, and Nader admits no Republicans have asked him to leave the race or expressed fear he will siphon votes from Bush. Quote, "I don't think they're in with the trend," unquote, Nader explained. But Nader insists his Republican backers are real. To find out more, I spent a good chunk of time over the last few weeks talking to Nader supporters in New England. I attended Nader meetups, Nader volunteer meetings, Nader campaign events, and Nader press conferences. I spoke with Nader supporters who were still in high school and Nader supporters with gray hair. I talked to people who have admired Nader since the 1960s and others who first heard of him last year. I found Nader supporters who have voted for him multiple times, Nader supporters who have never voted, and Nader supporters who voted for Al Gore in 2000. What I did not find, however, was a single supporter of Ralph Nader who voted for George W. Bush in 2000, or who had been planning to support Bush this year before Nader entered the race. After a while, I felt like a stymied naturalist stalking a rare species. Sure, Naderus Republicanus must exist somewhere, but it's an unusual creature capable of eluding human observation for long stretches of time. And those are very, very long stretches of time indeed. And skipping ahead, more about Nader and his Republican financial backers. Actually, the Dallas Morning News reported in March that about 10% of donations of more than $250 to Nader's campaign come from individuals with a history of contributing to the GOP. These donors remain coy about their motives. Nader chooses not to address the question head-on and instead typically cites a Center for Public Integrity study that says only 3% of his total contributions are from Republicans. It's curious that Nader, whose professed aim is to win the election, would advertise his minimal support from a large voting bloc, especially while claiming Republicans are ever more likely to support his 2004 campaign. Further questions about the nature of Republican funding for Nader seem likely to arise. Already, Arizona Democrats have claimed a GOP consultant is bankrolling the candidate's petition drive in Arizona. In short, the Nader campaign, like any other, contains its own inconsistencies. Nader complains the Democrats offer little beyond a critique of the Republicans, but much of his campaign consists of, well, a critique of the major parties. Nader says he wants to raise the tone, unquote, of the campaign, yet he merrily compares Al Gore to petrified wood, unquote. Nader also insists this is only his second presidential campaign. In 1996 and 1992, he says, "I just agreed to let the Greens put me on the ballot," unquote. In a complicated world, inconsistencies may be inevitable, but Ralph Nader portrays himself, it is the whole basis of his campaign, as a beacon of integrity in the fallen world of politics. Indeedy. By the way, considering Nader's Republican backers, evaluate the following. This also from Salon.com. This is from July 9th of 2004, an article by Eric Bielert, spelled B-O-E-H-L-E-R-T. The pronunciation may be wrong. It's called "Strange Alliance. Why is Rupert Murdoch's media empire publishing Ralph Nader's latest tome?" It reads in part as follows, after talking about a recent interview between Nader and recent discussion between Nader and former Democratic presidential contender Howard Dean. "Another good question Dean might ask Nader, critic of corporate-controlled Washington and foe of rampant media consolidation, is why Nader's new book, which arrived in stores this week and kicks off his presidential campaign, is being published by Rupert Murdoch. Chairman of the expansive conglomerate News Corporation, the conservative Murdoch has been a chief advocate for more than two decades of extensive media deregulation. And his HarperCollins is not only publishing Nader's The Good Fight, Declare Your Independence and Close the Democracy Gap, but providing the candidate with expensive public relations promotion and media bookings. Is this a coincidence or a backhanded way of helping Nader out, asks Chelly Pingree, president of Common Cause. I just think it's kind of hypocritical, unquote, says Tricia Enright, a former dean aide who now runs thenaderfactor.com. Quote, isn't Rupert Murdoch just the kind of corporate megalomaniac Ralph Nader despises? Unquote. Skipping down. But Murdoch's publication of Nader's book fits in with an emerging pattern of political activities. Recent news reports indicate Republican groups nationwide are actively aiding Nader's effort to secure space on election ballots in hope that he will hurt John Kerry's chances. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported that, quote, Bush-friendly forces have been openly aiding his ballot efforts in Oregon and Arizona, according to a review of Nader's Arizona petitions by the state Democratic Party. 65% of the signatories were Republicans. On June 27th, the Oregon chapter of Citizens for a Sound Economy, led nationally by former U.S. House Majority Leader Dick Armey and financed by the corporate interests that Nader has opposed, phoned members and said, quote, Nader could peel away a lot of Kerry support in Oregon. Liberals are trying to unite, but we could divide this base of support by signing up for Nader, unquote. Against that backdrop, Nader's alliance with the publishing arm of Murdoch, who has been a lavish supporter of Republican candidates and uses his media outlets, including Fox News, the New York Post, and the Weekly Standard to advance Republican causes and his own business interests, raises questions about the media mogul's intentions. Quote, I can't get in the mind of Rupert Murdoch or his motivation, unquote, says Gene Kimmelman, senior public policy director for Consumers Union, which opposes media deregulation. Quote, but is it plausible that there could be a political motive to promote Ralph Nader and help him draw votes away from the Democratic candidate who's opposed to further media consolidation? Of course it's plausible. Murdoch has a history of making decisions that involve politics that ultimately benefit his business. Well, indeed, and I wouldn't discount that in any size, shape, form, or manner here. In a recent discussion with Mark Ortiz, who is running for the Democratic nomination of the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina, we reiterated the Machiavellian orientation of the Bush administration, and that's something to consider in this context as well. The various programs I've done over the years are available from a CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed, annotated article-length description of For the Record 468 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Note that the Spitfire website is now equipped with a search function. Also, the consummately important book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning is now available on the Spitfire website for download. So please do take advantage of that. Also, be aware that sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/daymemory. Older shows are available at a longer URL linked to both that site and to the Spitfire website, the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 468, Through a Glass Darkly, a look at the 2004 elections. This is being recorded on 7/11/2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.